Si se puede. Si se puede. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Day 3 in Philadelphia and some very big Dems. Nope, it's not a demo. Mr. Kane delivered his motivational Tim talk.
Hillary is ready. She's ready to fight. She's ready to win. And she is ready to lead. God bless all of you.
A real billionaire from New York City delivered tips on how to evaluate people who say they are billionaires.
Trump says he wants to run the nation like he's running his business. God help us.
Vice President Joe Biden seemed to get real pleasure talking about torture.
We cannot elect a man who embraces the tactics of our enemies, torture.
And President Obama put his presidential gold star on someone's resume.
There has never been a man or a woman, not me, not Bill, nobody, more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as president of the United States of America.
Let's go to the TZ man on the scene at the Takeaway Sleep Deprivation Institute in Philadelphia. With these big guns, Hillary Clinton has some act to follow, wouldn't you say, Todd Zwillick?
John, she really does, no doubt about it. And we've been talking all week about what a huge night this is for Hillary Clinton herself, delegate after delegate who's wavering or not sure about Hillary or unconvinced or say they might not vote for her, say that they need to hear from her tonight. They need to hear about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They need to hear about those positions on trade and on foreign policy before they're convinced. And so this speech from Hillary seems like it is really important to convince or assuage a lot of tepid voters on Hillary. And it's important here too, John, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden did make their strongest positive case for Hillary last night here at the convention. But the real test of this campaign going forward isn't going to be in the Wells Fargo Arena. It's going to take place right outside the security cordons here in South Philly, in the neighborhoods of the city and in the suburbs. That's because Pennsylvania, which, you know, is always a battleground in these presidential years, could be the key this time around. The state has gone to Democrats in every presidential year since 1988. But this year, it is shaping up to be one of the most important states in what's likely to be a narrow path to victory for Donald Trump. Harry Enten is with 538, and I talked to him last week in Cleveland at the RNC.
I think the real question of this election is whether Donald Trump can break through in a state like Pennsylvania. This is a state that Republicans have argued that there are a lot of voters in the middle of the state, in the southwestern part of the state, these more cultural conservatives, whites without a college degree. Can Trump break through enough with them to offset his losses, say, in the southeastern part of the state, in the Philadelphia suburbs? If Donald Trump can carry Pennsylvania, he has changed the electoral map, he has broken through, and he could be on his way to the White House.
But it sounds like a low percentage shot for Trump to get Pennsylvania the way he's talking.
Well, there are 800,000 more registered Democrats in Pennsylvania than Republicans. So Hillary Clinton does have an advantage here. But listen to what Harry Enten is saying about how strong Trump could be with new voters or disaffected Democrats, whites without a college degree, in the middle of the state where I'm from or in southwestern PA. So the Trump campaign, of course, knows all this. I stopped by the Pennsylvania delegation's hotel in downtown Philly here to meet up with longtime Pennsylvania politics expert and pollster Terry Madonna. He's with Franklin and Marshall College.
The day after Trump and Michael Pence were nominated, Pence comes to the Pennsylvania delegation and literally said, "You're important, you're targeted." And look, Trump has been in this state Wednesday of this week. Where is he? In Scranton, Pennsylvania.
So, John, if places like southwestern PA and the middle of the state are big opportunities for Trump, that means that Philadelphia and the surrounding suburbs aren't. Philly, the home of the DNC this week, is heavily Democratic. Hillary Clinton will win here. But the question isn't whether she'll win. It's by how much. Philadelphia has become widely recognized as Clinton's firewall against Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. And that's why it's so important. Barack Obama got a whopping 85% of the vote in the city of Philadelphia in 2012 over Mitt Romney. So here's Terry Madonna again.
My sense is that I don't think Clinton's going to do quite that well for obvious reasons, but it's a key. And if she doesn't do well in Philadelphia talking about the firewall, if the turnout's down, then I think it's going to be very hard for her to carry the state.
Those are big ifs, though. I mean, if they really do a job of a ground game, it seems like they've got Pennsylvania and Ohio and game over.
And that ground game is critical, but don't forget Hillary Clinton's support isn't like Obama's support in those last 2 years. It's squishy. This is really important now. One key voter group is African Americans. Some polls have shown that Donald Trump is registering literally zero support among African Americans in the state of Pennsylvania. And half of all the Commonwealth's black vote lives right here in Philly. I bumped into former Pennsylvania Governor and Democratic Party Chairman Ed Rendell at the convention yesterday. He acknowledged that Philadelphia and the suburbs are a key firewall, of course, for Hillary.
I think we're definitely in play. I think Hillary will do actually better because of Donald Trump in the Philadelphia suburbs than even Barack Obama did. So I think she doesn't need quite as big a turnout as he had. But I think she'll get it because we have on our side the best turnout expert in the Democratic Party, President Obama, the turnout-er-in-chief.
Sounds like Rendell is agreeing with me. This is easy for Hillary.
But Rendell isn't taking into account there, John, just how cool and uncommitted some of Hillary's support might be. And here's going to be the problem. Joe Biden has roots in Scranton, PA, right? He'll, of course, campaign for Hillary there. But he and the president may have a huge job ahead of them in Philly this year to accomplish what you and Ed Rendell are talking about. John, Philadelphia is still old school Democratic politics, okay? There are still party bosses here, unions are huge, and the Democratic voting operation is a juggernaut. Everybody I talk to agreed that the Democratic machine is going to come out for Hillary and help build that firewall in November. But right now, it's weaker than they need it to be. Remember, it's not that Hillary just has to win Philadelphia. She probably has to win huge. Now, listen to this. Vance Morgan is a cab driver in Philly here. He drove our takeaway crew to the convention hall a couple of times this week. Morgan is African American. He voted for Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, but he says he finds Hillary Clinton calculating and insincere.
I'm actually not sure. I may sit this one out. I'm definitely not going to vote for Donald Trump. Definitely not. But Hillary Clinton has to make the case. I'm not going to just give it to her. I'm actually feeling that way, that I'm very disappointed in the products of both parties, Democrat and Republican, but Hillary Clinton has a chance to make the case.
I see. The old take the cab from the train station data point, Todd.
John, I totally get where you're coming from. Then how about Malia Fletcher on the streets of Philadelphia, not the typical cab driver? How about a public health expert and Democrat and Philly voter?
I actually voted for her when she was running against Obama. Now I'm not as enthused. I think she is still a really strong candidate. I think that she could have spoken up more regarding some of the foreign affairs elements. There are financial players that have certainly bought her voice, and it's kind of hard to see how she's going to play out as a leader.
Todd, what do you think of Ed Rendell's notion of Obama being the turnouter in chief? Did it sound that way last night?
Well, he definitely tried to play that role in part of his speech last night for Hillary Clinton, using that speech at the DNC to remind voters how she had won him over after their bitter primary battle in 2008.
We battled for a year and a half. Let me tell you, it was tough because Hillary was tough. I was worn out. She was doing everything I was doing, but just like Ginger Rogers, it was backwards in heels.
So, John, there's the first effort of many from the president coming up this fall. What does it all mean for the Democrats here? It means that if Donald Trump needs Pennsylvania to win because he's weak in other swing states, and Hillary Clinton is not exciting her natural base here in Philadelphia, she has a lot of work to do, and Trump supporters know it. Lee Snover is a Republican and a Trump delegate from Easton, Pennsylvania, about an hour east of here. I talked to her at last week's GOP convention in Cleveland. Listen to this.
Hello. Lower turnout's better for Republicans. That's why we win the off-year elections. That's why we do so well in, you know, judge races, municipal races. The lower turnout is favorable to Republicans.
So does the convention give them the firewall?
Well, John, Democrats want it to. That's probably why they chose Philly for their convention here. But listen to Terry Madonna, the political science professor from Franklin and Marshall College. He says it's not enough.
The Republicans were in Tampa 4 years ago, and who won? Not them. And the Democrats were in Charlotte, and who won? Not them. Carried the state. So there's no evidence that just because you hold a convention in a state, okay, you're going to win that state.
So, John, the Clinton campaign is getting started right away here. Hillary speaks at the convention tonight, of course. Then tomorrow the campaign does not move on. Clinton and Tim Kaine are set to hold a rally right here in the middle of Pennsylvania at Independence Hall. Then they get on a campaign bus headed west across Pennsylvania to Ohio, going right across the Commonwealth of PA and trying to cut right through the middle of Donald Trump's path to victory.
Most important speech of Hillary Clinton's career?
John, it has to be. Like I said, delegate after delegate, voter after voter say they might be willing to vote for Hillary. They're not convinced. Many of them are turned off by her. They need to hear from her directly. And then from now going forward, Joe Biden and Barack Obama, the turnouter-in-chief, I promise you, they're going to be in Philadelphia and the suburbs a lot because they need to do a better job here of getting voters excited about Hillary's candidacy.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, get a little sleep now.
Try to, John. Thanks a lot.
Here's a sign of the subtle diplomacy we can expect from a President Donald Trump. Listen carefully.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
Donald Trump's Bromansky, Hello Moskva, and Putin, a direct appeal to the Russians to nail down some secret emails for him to use against Hillary Clinton. Now, that might have got him arrested if this was the Cold War 1960s, but thoroughly modern Trump looks at Russia very differently than most Americans, perhaps. Is the Kremlin's influence in the 2016 election something other than a Le Carre secret spy conspiracy? DNC email leaks were reportedly the result of Russian state-sponsored hackers. No one is denying that, by the way. Donald Trump has business ties with Russia. Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, is still connected with Russia after working with the ousted pro-Russian Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. For a translation of what's going on here, we're joined by, I like to think of him as America's intellectual oligarch himself, Gary Steingart. He spent the early years of his life in Leningrad during the height of the Soviet Union in the early 70s, the author of highly acclaimed books like Absurdistan, Super Sad True Love Story, and most recently of Little Failure. Gary, what was your reaction to Donald Trump reaching out to Vladimir Putin?
Well, you know, it actually makes perfect sense. I think Donald Trump and Russia circa 2016 are good buddies. They make perfect sense in the sense that they're binded by racism, anti-Semitism, all these different things. They're both railing against political correctness. Things like Trump's birtherism are right up Russia's worldview. How can a black person run a major country? Stuff like that. The pile of money with a Star of David on it that Trump retweeted also could easily have been a Russian tweet. So for me, this is actually a very obvious alliance and a scary one, of course.
But there's also a quality here. I mean, you know, Democrats were outraged. Oh, my gosh. He's, you know, as though this was the era of the Cold War. And it's not. There's a huge intermixing of business people, expats, Russians in the United States and Russians back home who can't figure out if we're allies or adversaries, the U.S. and Russia. And the idea of influencing elections or politics is not that crazy for Russians to think about, yes?
Well, the thing is, you know, are we allies or are we adversaries? Of course, I wish that we had been allies at this point. That was everyone's dream after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But frankly, we are adversaries. There's no question that our interests are completely at odds on very many things. And when I mentioned, you know, racism, political correctness, there's a part of that as well. Our worldviews are just so different at this point. And Trump's actually, as I said before, is much closer to Putin's than he is to the majority of Americans, especially non-white Americans. And so there's a kind of very unholy alliance being built. And the only example I can think of in terms of world politics of something like this is when Berlusconi, the Italian leader, and Putin began their bromance quite a while ago. You know, we can only look at what happened to Italy after the many years of Berlusconi's regime and wonder if that's what's at store for us here.
Is there a constituency in the United States of Russian nationals who would prefer a Trump presidency? And in the same way that Israelis often express a preference to having one president over another because of national security issues, that, you know, this is much more above board than we might like to think?
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, so many ex-Soviet Jews in America are huge Trump supporters. There's a very large constituency that thinks Trump is strong, that's used to believing that strength is the most important quality you can have in a leader, and that everything else is just nonsense. You know, I remember a Thanksgiving that my parents had a while ago, maybe the first year of Obama's administration, and some Russian relative, I can't remember who it was, said, "I think Obama should be president, but of African country. This is a white country." And that exact kind of sentiment, I think, has echoed over the last 8 years. And Trump is seen as a savior, as somebody who will put an end to all that, which is really frightening for me, but I think absolutely true.
But, you know, this is what's so amazing. Anne Applebaum of The Washington Post on our program earlier this week said when she heard the reports of the leak coming from WikiLeaks that might have been orchestrated by the Russians, she said, oh, sure, this is exactly what they do in Ukraine to manipulate elections all over Europe. She said it's straight out of the Putin playbook. Yes. And I asked her, so, you know, are there Russian business people who have leverage over Trump? And she said, oh, sure. Oh, absolutely sure. Do you believe that?
I could believe that. I don't have evidence to the pro or con on that. So I can't say that I would know for sure. But of course, I would believe that. Listen, Putin knows exactly what he's doing. That's what's so amazing is you look at what happened in Ukraine. You look at what's happening to Western political parties. You look at Brexit. All these things are going exactly as the Russians would hope for and possibly have planned for. This is what's so interesting is that Trump brings evil and ignorance to the table. But Putin just brings evil. He's not ignorant. He knows exactly what he's doing. It's very clear who would be dominant in a relationship like that if there was at one point a Trump-Putin axis. You know, it's very clear who would be the Hitler, who would be the Mussolini in that one.
I'll take evil, hold the ignorance. That gives you Putin.
That's right.
Okay. Yes. Thanks for that. That's a good cheat sheet. Finally, why does it seem that Americans, perhaps generally speaking, and Trump supporters generally speaking, are not outraged by this overture to Russia, that there's something about, oh, blah, 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 fine?
Yeah, because I think people, a lot of people in the Republican Party, and this has been the case for a while, really do look up to Putin. They see nothing but unbridled strength. He wants Crimea, he'll take Crimea. He wants the Eastern Ukraine, he'll take the Eastern Ukraine. He doesn't care what anyone says about him. He doesn't care. Again, I'll bring up that term political correctness because it's one that they keep repeating. So having Putin and Trump together, it's like having two of the worst bullies in your elementary school take over the class, you know, while the substitute teacher goes to the bathroom. There's no rule of law. And that's somehow appealing. Of course, if you're a small, weak kid, you're done for because there's no one to protect you. But that kind of formulation, these two giant bullies striding across the globe, is something I think very appealing to a lot of people in today's GOP. And that's very unexpected. I mean, who would have thought that they would have turned to one of our adversaries with such clamor? But again, I think ideologically and emotionally, the connection between many right-wing people in America and Putin is just very, very strong.
There you have it. Gary Steingart possibly working on some of the great lines for his next book, writer most recently of Little Failure and Super Sad True Love Story, also Absurdistan. Gary Steingart, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Nicholas from Louisville, Kentucky. I think it's pretty horribly irresponsible and hypocritical for Trump to reach out to Russian hackers the way he did. I'm sure he'll pass it off as a joke, but at this point the damage is done and the request is out there. So that scares me that a potential president of the United States would act in this way.
That's Nicholas using the Anchor app to reach out to us. Download Anchor in your app store and search for The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Did you catch the story this week that 35 years after his attempt to assassinate President Ronald Reagan to secure the attention of actress Jodie Foster, John Hinckley Jr. is set to be released from St. Elizabeth Hospital after a judge ruled that he is no longer a danger to himself or society. He's going to live with his mother in Williamsburg, Virginia. Does the Hinckley case say something about America's mental health crisis in the criminal justice system that we talk about a lot on this program? Is Hinckley one of the lucky ones, or as an insanity defendant, just one of the rarest of the rare? Richard Bonney is a criminal law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law and director of the university's Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. Bonney says Hinckley's case points up how rarely real mental illness is ever taken into account in the U.S. prison system.
I can understand, actually, how some people might think, given the length of time that he has been at St. Elizabeth's, that maybe this was just punishment by another name. I don't think so. I think his case is actually illustrative of both the importance and the virtues of the insanity defense, and think also indicative of the care with which the criminal justice system and here the mental health system take to provide appropriate treatment to a person with mental illness and also to protect society.
So people who might be thinking, oh boy, John Hinckley coming out of St. Elizabeth's, coming out of custody, that's really the wrong way of looking at this. You would say that if everybody who's mentally ill in the criminal justice system got the treatment Hinckley got, we'd be a much better country.
Well, no, I don't think I would. I think it's important, actually, to view the special aspects of Hinckley's case and to keep them in mind here. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people with serious mental illness that are getting caught up in the criminal justice system, largely due, I think, to the unfinished business of deinstitutionalizing our mental institutions 50 years ago. Obviously, there are some cases in which people who have been charged with and have actually committed, you know, serious offenses were acutely ill at the time that they committed those offenses. And the question then at that point is how should the system handle those cases, both in deciding whether they should they were too ill, essentially, to be fairly punished, and if they were not responsible, as in Hinckley's case, we have to have an appropriate dispositional arrangement that carefully provides the treatment that they need in order to protect the public, but at the same time provides fairness to them so that they have an opportunity to show over a period of time that they can live safely in the community.
I think I'm understanding what you're saying, that in Hinckley's case, because of the use of the insanity defense, and possibly because this was such a high-profile case, justice for Hinckley was treatment at St. Elizabeth's. But for most defendants who have mental health problems of one kind or another, the question of justice and the question of treatment are separated, and there's no way in the United States right now to pull them together unless we offer more services in the prison system.
Or preventively in the community. We can keep mentally ill people out of the criminal justice system and divert them from the system if we provide the kind of adequate community-based treatment that they need. I think virtually everybody involved in mental health services and mental health reform issues is agreed that if we were actually able to beef up the mental health services system in order to provide services with people that people need before they spiral out of control, it would be best for them and it would also be best for society and the criminal justice system.
Richard Bonney, a criminal law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law and director of the university's Institute of Law, Psychiatry and Public Policy. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For those of you who managed to make it through the film Wolf of Wall Street,
celebrate with our weekly act of debauchery, I have offered our lovely sales assistant, Danielle Harrison, here $10,000 to shave a f***ing head!
Yeah! You might have asked yourself, where the heck was human resources while all this was going on? Men running wild with hot women and cold cash. This was director Martin Scorsese's vision of Wall Street, anyway. A quite different vision can be found in the new financial thriller Equity. Lose the testosterone and add Sarah Megan Thomas and Alicia Reiner, who developed, produced, and star in the movie. They sat down with our own sensitive male movie critic and Newsday critic Rafer Guzman to talk about getting away from the male cliches without turning the film into something written by corporate HR.
This idea really made me say yes, because doing the research, there was that frustration. And looking at, oh my God, Working Girl in 1986 was the last huge hit, which, by the way, was a huge hit.
Huge hit.
But the way women are portrayed in that world is so limited. And what if we could make this movie that is this super entertaining thriller, but also really show women in a way we've never seen them before and tell these real life women's stories.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that Working Girl was a rom-com, at its heart and soul. So that story could have been told outside of the Wall Street world. Our story cannot. Wall Street is a character in this movie.
Yeah.
early on in the film, one of the first things we hear is a speech by Naomi Bishop, played by Anna Gunn. She's at a mentoring panel for women, and she's telling them why she got into the business.
I like money. I do. I like numbers. I like negotiating. I love a challenge, turning a no into a yes. But I really do like money. I like knowing that I have it.
Now, I'm a little conflicted about this speech because in some ways this is the kind of thing that Gordon Gekko would say in Wall Street.
I actually think it's not.
Okay.
I think there's a big difference between saying I'm allowed to like money and owning that, and greed is good. I think those are actually really different.
You make a distinction.
And to me, actually, one of the differences between a woman saying it and a man saying it. And I think for women, owning your worth and owning what you're worth also financially and talking about money, which women are so hesitant to do. When we look at the statistics of women and asking for raises versus men, it's appalling. So I think it's a very, very big distinction, and particularly the difference between greed and worth.
Do you feel that I'm mistakenly saying I like money, equating greed? Is there something maybe a little sexist on my part about making that leap, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's like a sexist thing. I think it's that we don't talk about money. And that's kind of the tagline. One of the taglines for the movie is don't let money be a dirty word. Because why is it bad to make a lot of money if you work for it? I mean, I'm throwing that out there as a question, not that I have opinion on it. But I think hopefully with this movie, it's meant to start the conversation about how we talk about money and how we value it and how we use that to judge other people too.
Sarah, your character and Naomi at one point have to go on a roadshow of sorts for this tech startup called Cachet. And you're going around trying to convince people to invest in this startup. But the two of you, you in real life, had to do something pretty similar. What did your roadshow sound like, and who was it that eventually came forward with funds?
I love that you asked that. So thank God we have our amazing executive producer, Candy Street, and she was the first person to put money in. And not only did she invest, but then she threw these parties for us, and I think it was five altogether, where she would open her Rolodex and invite all of these women and a few men. And we had the opportunity to invite potential investors that we had identified. And we would do this roadshow where we, A, showed a trailer for the film. So we made like a little teaser because we hadn't made the film yet. So I like to be proud of my husband because he was the voice.
All right.
And he would say, she's not a secretary. She's not a prostitute. She's not the token woman in the background. Because that's what
smart.
We've seen in all of these movies, right? And then we did a PowerPoint presentation using the statistics that we found, using the statistics about Wall Street and female-driven content, and really showing that we were smart business women.
And one thing I just want to add that's kind of fascinating, because we put this into the film, how we got to Candy was through Men on Wall Street. So I read in the New York Times an article about a top Wall Streeter who will remain anonymous. And I read that he was a rower, which my last movie was about, and that he was on Wall Street. So I sent him a copy of my last movie and a handwritten note saying, we're making a movie about women on Wall Street, and Wall Street will not be depicted as evil with a blank stroke. Will you meet with me? And he did within 2 weeks. And then he introduced me to other men on Wall Street who were mentors to these women. That's an important point that we actually put in the script, that there are male mentors on Wall Street that actually have helped women and helped bring women up in this world.
Tell us a little bit about Broad Street Pictures, your company.
I would say Broad Street was founded to make this movie. Sarah and I had talked about working together, but we had to find the material that we really wanted to develop. And we talked about so many different things over a couple of years. And this was the one thing where we went, oh yeah, this is it. And we formed the company to create more roles for women, both behind and in front of the camera. And we're really proud to say we have a female director and a female writer, both of whom are genius. Our costume director, our production designer, so many of our cast and crew are female. And we're really excited because our next step with this is to develop a pilot based on the film. So that's Broad Street's next step.
All right.
That's where we're walking down that street.
I'm looking forward to that. I've been talking with Sarah Megan Thomas and Alicia Reiner. They're the writers, producers, and stars of Equity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The film Equity opens in theaters on Friday. You know, if you really want full-strength testosterone, forget money and power. Think about the ways in which Americans learn about something we hear about all the time in patriotic political campaigns. Honor, or I should say, honor.
Honor to the end.
No bastard ever won war by dying for his country.
Private Santiago is dead.
A thousand years of war.
But he is dead because he had no code.
You want it? By making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
He is dead because he had no honor.
The greatest warriors the world has ever known.
All real Americans love the sting of battle.
The reason they fight, lost to the ages.
Honor sounds like social cyanide, turning people into suicidal maniacs who throw themselves off cliffs for some dubious concept of defending a code. Kind of scary, this thing called honor, but we're taught to believe it's a good thing. You've noticed there's no congressional medal of stepping back and thinking this thing through again, right? Is honor a good thing? Ryan P. Brown is the author of Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche.
When most people hear the word honor, they think of really good things like virtue or excellence or duty or respect. Those are all perfectly legitimate meanings of the word honor, but when a social scientist talks about honor, we mean something pretty different. These kind of cultures tell men that they need to be brave and strong and intolerant of disrespect, and they tell women to be loyal to their family at all costs and sexually chaste. And living up to these kinds of expectations really is what it means to earn honor in these sorts of cultures.
Before we get into all of the consequences of honor, would you say that honor is an adaptive quality of human beings, that it came about as a way of better enabling humans to, you know, be fruitful and multiply, that sort of thing?
Honor cultures develop in places where there's a general pervasive sense of economic insecurity. That's generally true where there's a lot of poverty, but also where whatever you have is very portable, so it can be taken from you easily. So when you put those factors together, people will respond to that sort of a social ecology by developing an honor culture that says reputation is everything. I'm going to defend my reputation. So it is adaptive in that sense. It's sort of an adaptive social response to a lot of brokenness.
In American history, there was certainly a lot of brokenness and a lot of things that became broken as a result of contact with Europeans. But out of that, I think, come very powerful myths or stories about honor in the American West. The Godfather is an example, sure. All the way up to gang culture in the late 20th century. How does honor play in these various stories as we go down through time?
Think about inner city gang culture. It's a great example that you bring up. If you live in a poor urban community, you've got those two factors that I just talked about that tend to lead to the development of honor cultures all around the world. You've got poverty. The little bit of wealth that you might have is very portable. It's stuff that can be taken. And if somebody threatens your stuff, the police aren't likely to show up. You're not likely to call them, but even if you did, they're not likely to show up in that kind of environment. You rely on your reputation as being someone who's not to be trifled with to protect you. So you have these same social factors coming together in poor urban communities that you have in, say, southern Scotland or in Sicily, in the development of the Italian mafia, or the Middle East, other places around the world that have these honor cultures. It's really ultimately the same factors coming together to produce these. But long after those factors have disappeared from memory, after they've faded into history, you still may have these social norms that stick around that say honor is everything. Do whatever it takes to defend your honor, because if you lose it, you might not be able to get it back.
How does honor complicate family life?
A lot of the early research on the dynamics of honor showed up in studies of homicide rates. Because the southern and western United States tend to be more honor-oriented than the northern United States does, argument-related homicides were more common in the south and in the west than they are in the north. And it's important that they're argument-related homicides, because these are murders that take place in response to what the police often refer to as a trivial altercation. So it began with somebody making a face or a rude comment to someone else, and then that person had to respond, and then the first person responds to that response, and before you know it, they're out in the parking lot beating each other up or stabbing each other. But then within the family, we're also finding that domestic homicide is more prevalent in honor-oriented states. If a husband believes his wife is cheating on him, if he lives in an honor culture, he's gonna feel his honor is under threat, it's under attack, and he's gonna respond aggressively.
It seems as though the imperative for so many communities is to figure out ways of, you know, dialing down the voltage of honor, of neutralizing it, to allow other things to take place. Have there been any places that have been successful in doing that?
So there are parts of the world that seem to have progressed away, developed away from this sort of honor code. We often refer to them as dignity cultures. In a dignity culture, you don't have to earn a basic sense of value. You have value, you have worth or dignity simply by virtue of being a human being. And that doesn't have to be earned, so it can't be lost or taken away from you.
How does honor determine how we reward people in wartime and in athletics, that sort of thing?
So part of the honor ethic, especially for men, is to be brave and to be loyal and to be tough. So you can tolerate pain, you're willing to risk your life, and you're willing to take risks in protecting your honor or protecting the honor of your family or your teammates or your comrades. In sort of one of the brighter sides, we found that soldiers from more honor-oriented states in the U.S. were more likely than chance to win the Congressional Medal of Honor during World War II. On the flip side, looking at college football teams, teams that have more players from so-called honor states in the U.S. are more likely to suffer penalties for personal fouls and unsportsmanlike conduct. This, we think, is a similar manifestation of sort of reckless abandon in the pursuit of collective honor.
Ryan P. Brown is the author of Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
And thank you so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.